Well, we're working our way through Paul's letter to the Philippians, and a couple of weeks ago we saw in verses 6 to 11 how Paul focused our attention onto the realities that lie at the very heart of the Christian message. Christ Jesus, the one who we read verse 6 was in very nature God, the one who gave up all his divine rights and came down to be born on earth. Came not just to live the perfect life, but to die a unique death. The only person in the universe who didn't deserve to die under the curse of God, and yet he went obediently to death on the cursed cross. And that's where we see exactly the sort of God he is. The sort of God who doesn't claim his own rights, but in humility and love puts other interests, the interests of others, before his own interest. And therefore, we read, he was declared to be the Lord of the whole universe, the one before whom every knee will bow. And verse 12 begins, therefore. And that is because the truth about Jesus Christ is always followed by a therefore. The truth about Jesus is never just a kind of point of interest, something to muse upon. It is truth with arms and legs. That's to say, it doesn't just sit there. It gets up and it does something. It grabs you. It grabs hold of our lives and says, things cannot be the same ever again. From now on, everything must be different. And the difference that Paul is wanting the truth to make in the lives of his dear friends is that they should be people who, verse 12, should continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. We were due to look at the whole of this section from chapter 12 right on to the end, verse 30, but there is so much in those two verses, verses 12 and 13, that we'll just look at those and we'll sort of save the rest till a date at the end of August. And the way I want to tackle these two verses is to break them into two halves, look at each half, and then end by putting the two halves back together again. See where we get. So first half is this. Work out your salvation. Work out your salvation. And we read, verse 12, Paul says, continue to work out your salvation. And we tear our hair out. Because one minute we're reading Paul in the New Testament, and he's saying salvation is a matter of faith. Faith in what Jesus has done. Now he seems to be saying, work out your salvation. Do what it takes to sort yourself out. Well, we need to remember to whom he's speaking. He's not talking to people who are wondering how to become right with God. He's talking to people who are already right with God. People who in verse 1 he describes as saints. People who've been set apart for God. People who in verse 6 he describes as people in whom God has begun a good work. And now, he says in our verse, therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, you're already Christians, so continue to work out your salvation. And if we're to understand what Paul means by this phrase, work out your salvation, we just need to remind ourselves what he means by salvation. What is their salvation? Well, they were in a wrong relationship with God. They had said no to him. And therefore they faced God's eternal no to them. But in Christ, God acted to save them from his eternal no. His death transformed God's eternal no into eternal yes. So they were all wrong with God, but through Christ, he has put them right with himself. Friends again. And that's why it's no surprise that the Philippians' lives as Christians have been marked by obedience. As you have always obeyed. See, if you've been put right with God, well, the right relationship with him is one in which he is Lord and we are his servants. So the right thing to do is to obey him. That's the right way to relate to God. That's what they've been doing. And Paul says, my dear friends, you are right with God. Now work that being right with God out into every corner of your lives. So it's not cool to save themselves by trying to be better people. It's a call in line with the pattern we keep meeting in Philippians and in the Bible. It's not God saying, now try and get right with me. It's God saying, I have made you right with me. Now live that out. Be what you are. Make sure there is no corner in your life where you let yourself live in a way that is wrong with me. And we say, yeah, but what will that mean? What will a life right with God mean? What will it look like? And that's why Paul has directed their attention to Jesus. And when I see Jesus, the Jesus of verses 6 to 11, I see that is what it means to be right with God. And I see that, and then that therefore, in verse 12, makes sense. I see in Jesus, the life that is right with God, and therefore, something needs to follow on. There is work to be getting on with in my life. See, when I see him, I realize that there are corners of my life where I'm not living in a right relationship with God. There are corners of my life that are decidedly wrong with God. Think of the way we conduct our friendships. Think of what we do with our tongues. The way we gossip. But we don't call it gossip, of course. We call it telling you about someone else for your prayers. But it's basically gossip. Think of our pride. Think of how again and again we want other people to be impressed by us. Think of the way we're very judgmental towards other people. I'll just plug the technology back in. What was I saying? Oh yeah, think of the way we are. Think of our pride. Think of the way we're judgmental towards others. Not very generous in dealing with their faults. Very quick to see the way they go wrong. Think of the way we deal with our money. The way we moan and grumble, all those things that we know so well about ourselves. And if I look at myself and then I look at Jesus, I soon see that I'm just taking the first few kind of wobbly baby steps out on a life that is right with God. There is a long way to go. Therefore, work it out, says Paul. It's as though the light in the centre of the room is basically on. It shines on all the central features, the table, the chairs. There is enough light to live by, to eat by. So the light of salvation is on in the centre of my life. And its central features are basically right with God. My heart is full of love for him. I want to get to know him better. I want to serve him. I want to obey him. I want to tell my friends about him. There has been a basic shift. The light has gone on. A shift from being all wrong with God and just living for myself and being put right with God and living for him. But as I go on in the Christian life, I see that there are corners of the room, the edges, that are still in shade. And the more time I spend looking at Jesus, his life, right with God in every detail, the more I see that there are dark corners in my life that are still all wrong. So I say something unkind. It's just a small thing, but it's so careless. It hurts them so much. And then I look at Jesus, this Jesus of verses 6 to 11, and I realize he would never have said that. Because every detail of his life was right with God. So salvation is being put right with God. And working out your salvation means shining the light of being right with God into every little corner of my life. I am right with God. But now has this little corner of my life come into line with that? Is my life in this area right with God? Does it look like I'm living as someone who is right with God? Am I dealing with this little area in the Jesus way? The way of humility. The way of unreserved obedience. The way of limitless generosity. The way that gives up my rights and puts others first. What we tend to do is we leave certain areas in the dark, on the edges of the room where the light can't get to. And we sort of give ourselves permission not to have them exposed. We sort of tuck them behind things, bits of furniture, so the light doesn't get to them. One example, in England, in certain Christian circles, it was like everyone had given one another permission not to have to be right with God in the area of sharp put-downs. That's to say, clever comments that people make in arguments to make other people feel small, so that you can sort of show off your learning and your so-called wit. And people who in every other way were trying to work out their salvation and live right with God in every detail, but in this area, somehow it was sort of agreed upon that salvation was not allowed to shine its light into this area. It was just part of a particular sort of competitive, slightly elitist, slightly showing off culture, really, that people had grown up with. It was in their blood. And it was as though the gospel was not allowed to touch it. And the funny thing is, if you'd said a rude word, people would have been terribly shocked and taken you to one side and told you not to use rude words. But although these sharp words, these put-down words, are much more hurtful than rude words, no one seemed to be allowed to question them. It's just an area that we didn't want our salvation to touch. And I don't know what it is quite for us here. For people from a kind of student background, it might be to do with assuming that we're always right. That's a trap we very easily fall into when we think we've got a bit of learning up our sleeves. That's easily one of the areas we don't want salvation to shine into. We're just so used to being right that the humility to recognise that we might not be just doesn't really feature. But whatever it is, there will be things about the way we operate that we won't want our salvation to touch. And Paul says, you're right with God. Now, work that out in every area of your life. Not just the basic, you know, I evangelize, I read my Bible, I say my prayers, I don't murder people. But look at Jesus and see what it means to be right with God. Now, in which area did he not bother much about being loving? In which area was he not that fussed about pleasing his Father in heaven? No, work out your salvation into every single corner. But Paul, say the Philippians, how? How, if you're not here to help us, if you're in prison, how will we do this? And Paul's answer in verse 13 is, you can do it, for it is God who is at work in you. For it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. And that's the second half of the equation. The first half was, work out your salvation. And the second half is, for it is God who works in you. Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but how much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. Not only in my presence, says Paul, but now much more in my absence. He says, don't think that my presence, my being with you, is essential to your Christian life. Salvation is not something you got from me. It's from God. It's God's gift to you. And he is at work in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. And so the preacher and the pastor and the older Christian and even the apostle, They are tools, good tools God uses to work in people's lives, but they're just tools. He is the worker, and it's his work. A great demonstration of this in recent times was the situation in China. Do you remember all the missionaries and church leaders were kicked out of China at one stage because Christianity seemed to be sort of associated with the sort of imperialist past. And everyone thought, ah, what hope for this baby church in China. Now all the leaders have been kicked out. And when the missionaries were allowed back in again, they couldn't believe how the church had grown and grown and grown. God's work. God's work. And the outside world looks on and it says, I can explain church, I can explain what's going on in church, all in sort of sociological and psychological terms. It's that sort of a phenomenon. It's like-minded people with traditional values in common hanging out together because they feel like a sort of minority. Or it's lonely people given some sense of belonging by being part of a group. Or it's people without any sense of an identity, finding their identity and a role they are given in an institution. Or it's weak people just wanting to submit to external authority. It can all be explained in sociological and psychological terms. And Paul says, no, you have not understood what is going on in the church until you have seen that what is going on is nothing less than the living God of the universe grabbing hold of people and working in their lives. And sometimes we don't quite believe that for ourselves. So one of the great temptations for younger Christians is to sort of want to depend on the person who helped them or the institution to whom they owe so much. And the great temptation for the older Christian or for the institution is to let them depend on us. We think that is the sort of safest way. But the great Apostle Paul wants these Philippians to know that they will never take off in the Christian life until they see that their salvation doesn't depend on him. If they start to depend on him, then what will they do when he is killed? Or if he fails and lets them down? Or when they move to a new town and can't spend time with him. You see, if he is functioning as the kind of stabilizers on their bicycle, you know, the little wheels you put on a bicycle for kids? If he is functioning as the stabilizers, and those stabilizers are suddenly removed, they will topple over because they never really learned how to ride a bike. And the day we really set off cycling in the Christian life is the day we realize that we've not just resolved to be a better person. We've not just joined a group of nice people who make us feel good about ourselves. We're not just part of a club where we feel we belong. Not just a member of an institution that I find a helpful influence in my life. No, the Christian is someone who can say, I have received the gift of salvation from the living God. He has taken hold of me and he is at work in me. And there are people who have been going to church all their lives, but they've never seen that. They're part of the scene. They help with the coffee. They play the organ. But as far as they can tell, it's just about membership of a sort of social club. And obviously I can't see into hearts tonight. But it could be that there are people here tonight who've been coming to church for years and you call yourself a Christian, but the idea that God is at work in you seems very strange, very alien. But that is what the New Testament is talking about when it talks about what it is to be a Christian. Not someone who's just trying to be better, not someone who belongs to a social club, but someone whom the living God has grabbed and in whom the living God is at work bringing about his purposes. Don't settle for anything less than that. If you're a Christian tonight, you'll be kind of nodding on the inside. You'll be looking back over the last year or so and you'll be able to say, yeah, that's the story of the last year. God has been at work in my life to make all the corners of my life right with him. One of the reminders that it's his work and not our own attempt just to become sort of better people is the way he teaches us lessons that we don't even want to learn. Okay. You going to sit down, my friend? Right? Okay. One of the reminders that it's his work and not ours is the way he teaches us lessons we don't even want to learn. So you know when you go and visit friends in another part of the country and you join them for church and you're sitting in the sermon and it's like they have told the preacher what to say because what he said spoke straight to you and you realize they didn't tell the preacher what to say, but this is God putting his finger on an area of your life that he's wanting to deal with. It's not a lesson we particularly wanted to learn, but God is at work in us and he will do his work. Sometimes that teaching comes through sorrows, through disappointments, and we would never have chosen to learn these lessons, these painful lessons of being broken, being humbled, being shown that we're not as strong as we thought we were, and that we need him very much. But God is at work teaching us what it means to be right with him in every corner of our life. So the first half, work out your salvation. And you can do it, even though I'm in prison, because you're not on your own, for God is at work in you, the second half. And in our final section, I want to kind of answer the question, how do those two halves fit together? Is it us or is it God? The biblical logic is work out your salvation because it is God who is at work in you. Well, that sounds very strange to us. The history of the church is in fact littered with people who got hold of one half and not the other. So there's been a kind of legalism that has got hold of the first half, work out your salvation, and said it's all down to us folks, just try and make ourselves better people, invent rules, cultivate techniques for improving ourselves. And there's also been on the other side a kind of laziness movement that said, well, it's all down to God, that God is at work in you. So we have the holiness movements in this century, whose slogan was something like, let go and let God. And the way to grow in godliness was to stop trying to be godly, just to let God do it. He is at work in you. And what happens if you get hold of just one half of the verse and not the other? And do you remember the sailing boat I mentioned when we were looking at a similar piece of biblical logic back in chapter 1? Do you remember one summer I was invited to sail on a pretty fancy yacht in the Mediterranean, eventually to deliver it to its destination in port in Greece. And the slight snag about this arrangement was that I can't sail. I've got no sea legs. I only know one knot. But luckily, the whole operation was in the hands of Dave. And Dave, it turns out, was a first-class yachtsman. And he could get me there single-handed. He didn't even need me on the boat. And the legalist says, work out your salvation. There's the yacht, here are the keys, sail it to Greece, and you'll be given points on how well you do. See, and what happens? We try, and we fail. We constantly capsize, or we're stuck, motionless on the sea because we can't find the wind. See, by ourselves, we never get to Greece. It's impossible. We are non-sailors. Such a relief to discover we're not left alone. The yacht is in the hands of a captain who will get it to port. And alone in the Christian life, we do not stand a chance. We have no ability to make ourselves godly. So legalism, the kind of attempt to make myself godly, will always fail. On the other hand, the lazy man says, for it is God who is at work in you. Ha-ha. Relax. He'll get you there. Just sit on the deck. Soak up the sun. enjoy a Coke with ice and lemon and one of those curly straws. And what happens? Well, I may get to Greece, but I've learnt nothing about sailing. You see, Dave's plan was not just to get us to Greece. It was to make sailors of us, to teach us to sail. And God's purposes are not just to sort of technically make us right with him so we get a pass that will let us into heaven. His purpose is to actually make of us people who are right with him, walking in a way that is right with him. And the mark that I understand that Dave wants to make sailors of us is what? What do I do if I understand that? Well, he can't make a sailor of me if I'm just lazing around on deck with a book. And I can't teach myself to be a sailor. I have no nautical knowledge. I need to go to him and ask him to take me under his wing. If I'm to become a sailor, I need to be up early, report for duty, not head off and sort of randomly pull any rope I find, but get Dave to teach me, to watch him, spend time with him, take on board his instruction, follow his example. And the evidence that I understand what God wants to make of me, that he wants to make me godly, is similar. I don't learn godliness by sitting around, desperately trying not to learn, letting go and letting God, saying, Lord, just let me know when we're there. I'm not a mystical machine into which God just sort of slots a kind of godliness microchip, just makes me godly. Now, the Christian life is a relationship. And I don't learn outside of that relationship. I don't learn by trying to teach myself religion and getting God to sort of mark my score at the end of the journey. So, see, my chosen syllabus would be very different from his. I learn by going to him each day, spending time with him, listening to his instruction, listening to what he has to say to me through the scriptures, doing whatever it takes to come under his word so that he can shine his light into every corner of my life. So if it helps me to take it in, I'll bring a pencil and a notepad to sermons, or I'll be reading Christian books, or I'll be travelling in the tram with tapes, sermon tapes on. I'll do whatever I can to expose myself to his light so that his ways touch even the very dark corners on the edges of my life. The legalist gets nowhere. It's an impossible task. And the lazy man gets nowhere. Godliness doesn't sort of magically happen while we sleep. The Bible's logic is that his being at work in me, bringing about my salvation, will mean I will be busy working out that salvation. He gives me the appetite and the energy to do what I could never do without him. Precisely because he is at work in me, I go to him and say, Lord, teach me, transform me, make me more like Jesus. And those who see that the living God is at work in them are those who work out their salvation with, do you see at the end of verse 12? With fear and trembling. See, up to that point, it's pretty casual. It's just a Sunday thing. But now, it's deadly serious. Now we're talking about being in the hands of the living God. Now everything must come under his light. Let's pray together.